Hello, and welcome to episode 22 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panellists include runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Melbourne Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Includes, probably a strong word here.
And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals Top 8 competitor.
Hey, Brian.
Yes, it's just Shieldsy and myself tonight, just thought we'd bring it down a notch, you know, take it down to a bit more personal level, you know.
Yeah.
Talk about a few things which are important to us, obviously including Netrunner, because Netrunner is extremely important to both
Netrunner's
of us.
Gas.
Yes, yeah. Netrunner's gas.
Really good.
So basically, in the last few episodes we did a series of segments which you referred to as meta strategy segments, where we talked about control decks, aggro decks, and mid-range decks. And this was sort of definitely something we've imported from Magic the Gathering, because we've all got a Magic background, and we think it's a good way to talk about just deck archetypes in general without trying to shoehorn them into any particular type like Glacier or Fast Advance, and it's really giving them a more blanket sort of statement. So, Shieldsy, you want to talk a bit more about why we chose to do that, because we've got you've got a bit of a different way of looking at the game which has developed.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about how we learn about the game. Obviously, it's very, very different to other games. Because of the asymmetry, it's taken me a while to get a good grasp on a good model for the game to think within. So this idea of aggro, mid-range, and control is very different from the ideas of Glacier and like Fast Advance and things like that. And basically a few weeks ago when we were testing Order and Chaos, we actually stumbled across a Fast Advancing Glacier control deck, and that just blew my mind. The fact that we were playing Wayland's Advanceable Ice with Trick of the Light and scoring 4-for-2s out of hand, holding it all together with Gigantic Ice.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why the blanket statements of control mid-range aggro are more flexible than to say, like, that deck you're talking about, like, is it a Glacier deck? Because you're playing Giant Ice.
It is a Glacier deck.
Or is it a Fast Advance deck?
It is a Fast Advance deck.
Well, how can you be both?
Exactly right.
What did the deck end up actually being clarified under our system or the Magic system?
Well, we just call it the control deck.
Yeah.
We just call it the control deck because it has that element of inevitability we talked about in control. In the control episode, it has that element of weakness in the early game that not every control deck has, but this one certainly did. In Netrunner, the control archetypes, be they runner or corp, this comes back to that question we talked about the other week, and this is certainly the how. This is certainly how you assess whether a deck is an aggro deck or a control deck or a mid-range deck. It all comes back to that question, who's the beatdown? And as a control deck, when you ask yourself who's the beatdown, you'll find that more often than not, it's not you. It's your opponent. You very rarely have positions to take initiative. And if you do take initiative too early, if you find a window to take initiative, often, unless you're prepared, unless you are late enough in the game, often you'll be trading away your inevitability to take that initiative early in the game.
This comes back to the idea of the control deck giving up its early game impetus,
exactly,
correct?
Yeah.
Like, so I mean, you start the game on the back pedal in a lot of ways,
basically,
because you can't afford to raise your ice a lot of the time, so you're going to cop a few accesses.
As a control deck, not only do you not have the initiative at the start of the game, or not only are you not the beatdown as the game begins, but your opportunities to take control of the initiative, your opportunities to pressure your opponent back or start getting in there and doing some damage or start making some large runs or start tearing up some servers or trashing through some ice. Those opportunities, not only do they not come up very often, but you have to let most of them go. Yeah, that's a trade-off. It's a trade-off you're making to gain the inevitability in the long game. So control decks on both the runner side and the corp side, they are more reliable, they're more consistent over a long game. They're also more susceptible, especially on the corp side, they're a little bit more susceptible to variance just in the early game because of the way they're agenda points are so densely located in cards. You know, you might be playing 7 5-for-3s in an HB Glacier deck, or you might be playing
5 5-for-3s in a government takeover,
or 3 Glen Stations, some NAPD contracts, and a government takeover, and some Trick of the Lights. You know,
Do you think it's still worthwhile categorizing both runner and corp decks in the same fashion? Seeing as if a aggro runner comes up against a controlling corp, I think they are riding a bit on what you're saying, which is relying on that variance to try and get that early game advantage. Whereas I think conversely, if it's an aggro corp versus a controlling runner, the aggro corp can just sit there and start winning the game while the runner is trying to, get their pieces together for that late game inevitability. So would you say it's the same thing? Because the aggro deck as a corp does have the capacity to win very quickly, whereas the aggro runner against a controlling corp, because the agendas are so thinly spread out, can't necessarily win as quickly in the early game.
So why are controlling runner decks still called control decks? Well, like they are separated in terms of their terminology. The nomenclature is separate enough because we already can say that they're either runner decks or corp decks, right? So like the terminology, it means slightly different things on both sides of the game, but you know what, you compare control decks to mid-range decks to aggro decks as runners, all as runners, or you compare them as all as corps. And just what you're saying there about controlling corp decks being stronger against aggressive runner decks, I think it's probably about the same in terms of the corp's advantage in either of these situations. And we'll come to back to this later. Essentially, what I've been discovering as I've been trying to push the limits of aggressive corp decks and try and push the limits of what it is to be an aggressive runner deck is that anytime the corp is faster or slower than the runner, just in the broad sense of it, the corp has the advantage.
Of course, yeah.
Whereas anytime the runner is the same speed, they have the advantage. And so it's just taken a little while for the game to get to this point where we have that depth that you can put together all these different aggro corp decks and all these different controlling runner decks. Because at the beginning of the game, there really wasn't that many variations in the decks you could pilot. You know, it's very difficult to draw similarities between two different controlling corp decks or two different aggressive corp
Yeah,
decks when there's
of
only one.
course. Like before, Honor and Profit, as you pointed out, the only real aggressive corporation deck would have been NBN or Hearthspire or Fast Advance. Whereas now you've got Jinteki dedicated damage decks, which are very aggro. And now with Argus Security, we have the potential. Not, I don't think anyone's figured it out just yet, but to have a really aggressively scoring and aggressively threatening meat damage Argus deck as well. Whereas before it was just straight up Fast Advance.
Yeah,
And
I
I think
think
it's similar as well with Control as well. I think for a while, the reason everyone just called Control decks Glacier was because Glacier was the only really controlling strategy you had. Yeah.
Tollbooth was by far the best controlling.
It's still very, very good.
It's still insanely good, yeah. Honor and Profit changed a lot. The end of that second cycle, that changed a lot for the game. And we did see an extension in both directions in the corpse capabilities. We saw the control direction feed out into what became the RP lists with Caprice Nisei and with Nisei Mark II and with Sundews and Tsurugis
Yeah, Box really gave RP the teeth it needed to be competitive, and it's still very strong.
And we really don't have any control decks that seem about as powerful as RP yet. And it's a shame it seems misplaced in the metagame with so many Anarchs. Maybe we'll see some developments in HB Glacier,
When
Domestic Sleepers
you
this year
say
as well.
misplaced, do you mean it's unfavorably matched up,
I think
or?
it's unfavorably matched up against a lot of Anarchs, yeah. Well, almost every Anarch will play Parasites, right?
Sure. But do
And
you think that's just a call on what ice they're going to include? Maybe they don't play as Tsurugi and Kamainu. They play one or the other.
yeah, I mean, Kamainu's lost a lot of lost a lot of quality in the deck, and now with maybe a rise in Switchblade as well, Tsurugi doesn't really have that much strength either, and that's what held the deck together for a long time. So it may need to see a bit of a bottom up redevelopment. Maybe it doesn't get to play Ashe anymore. Maybe it plays Tollbooth. Now Tollbooth is really strong. Maybe we'll see a rise in Knight, and something like Ashigaru can come back in.
While we're on the subject of replicating perfection, our friend Dave Hoyland, the top eight competitor from Worlds, who we had on for a few episodes for our Order and Chaos review, he has been running and having some success with a replicating perfection deck that runs the Grail
The
Ice.
Grails, yeah.
Do you think that still comes under the banner of a control deck, even though people who would normally think of a control deck as a Glacier deck with these big impassable ice when you're playing something like Galahad, which is fairly permissible?
This comes back to what Wilfie was saying. I think back in like episode 2, episode 3 maybe, we were talking about this HB Fast Advance list and trying to compare it to the Near Earth Hub Fast Advance list. And
And it's nowhere near as fast, no.
he was like, oh well, it's a little bit slower, but they're not really that different. And I agree with him here, even though it's kind of the contrapositive. Wilfie was saying that those decks weren't very different, even though they had a lot of different cards. And I'm going to say now, this RP deck is really different from the Grail build, even though they're still the same identity. They still play all the Sundews. They still play the same agendas, basically. Just having those Grails changes the deck up a lot. Like the package of 9 Grails and maybe like 2 Corporate Troubleshooters makes the deck a mid-range deck.
I must say that I was testing with our friend Connor the other day, and I was playing an Anarch deck, and he wiped my rig twice. Two separate occasions. One because I ran face first into a Merlin that I couldn't break because I didn't know he was playing Grails. And the second time because I ran into that Merlin again thinking that it was a Caprice Nisei on the route when in fact it was a corporate troubleshooter. So yeah, it's a very, very, very sort of mid-range tactics there for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a really early redevelopment of the model I made for myself in Corpse was recategorization of the ice. Because we've talked a lot about ice being separate types and separate strengths and separate costs and getting a lot of diversity out of that. But we've never really focused too much on the subroutines. We kind of said, you know, it's end the run and trash, and then maybe the rest is worth half a click. Maybe, you know what, we can go deeper. So I think you can also classify ice as either binary, threatening, or taxing.
Yeah, 100%. Binary ice is obviously ice that can turn off as soon as your opponent plays a type of breakers. For instance, a good example is Enigma and Yogg. Quandary and Yogg.
Paperwall is possibly the most binary ice.
Of course, yeah, yeah. So yeah. Paperwall and yeah. Corroda.
But also Neural Katana is binary.
Yeah, Neural Katana, they play their Mimic or whatever.
Guard is binary.
Guard, yeah, very much so.
All these ice turn off as straight away, as soon as they find their breaker.
And binary ice is not the type of ice you're going to find in a control deck, right?
Not unless they're doing something strange.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have...
Because binary, the idea of playing a binary piece of ice is to force your opponent to get that breaker out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And preferably you're going to want that ice to end the run.
Yeah.
So you're going to be playing it in some sort of aggressive list,
otherwise
I would imagine.
They have to get their breaker. Yeah. Yeah. Like Neural Katana isn't quite as strong a binary piece of ice as Paperwall is as a binary piece of ice, because they can always just draw three cards and then pitch those three cards again to go through.
It's not as strong as Rototurret either when it comes to binary ice though, right?
No, that's an excellent sentry. As a binary piece of ice. You know, it has that extra trash, but it ends the run. And that's the thing. The end the run forces them to get their breaker.
Yeah.
And even though that doesn't tax them on the way through again, what it buys you is tempo. You pay very little resources. They probably pay very little resources as well, but just by having binary ice as the corp, you buy tempo.
We do throw this term around quite often. For those people who may be unfamiliar with some of these terms, like it is a magic term as well. When we talk about tempo, what are we actually talking about?
If I say, I just earned some tempo, it's when my opponent passes turn back again and nothing's changed for them. So if I get to develop my board position while theirs is floundering about, I feel like I've gained tempo. If my opponent draws four cards in their turn and they miss everything they needed, I just gained tempo.
So the same example as if they sit there and click pressure contacts four times, is you still viewing that as gaining tempo, even though they're both drawing cards and gaining credit?
Yeah, it kind of depends. You can always turn credits into accesses, provided you have the breaker. And so whilst they're contacting, they're both ahead of time, they're gaining the potential for accesses, as well as gaining the cards they need to make the accesses. Whereas simply drawing cards, unless they draw cards that gain them credits, and then they play those cards as well, which takes more time, more clicks. They're simply drawing cards isn't going to get them ahead in terms of accesses. And that's what I consider important. That's what I'm measuring here as actually getting something done.
So going back to the ice conversation, so we had binary ice, taxing ice as well. So example of taxing ice would be Tollbooth, as we were talking about. Is the quintessential taxing ice.
Heimdall. Ashigaru.
So these are the type of ice where the corp is usually paying a very large investment, so like between, you know, 7 and 10 credits. In turn, that piece of ice is going to cost the runner a lot of resources every time they want to go through it. Is that correct?
Yeah. In terms of a long game, taxing ice is the most efficient credit per credit. So you put in the least credits that you can to get the most credits out of the runner's pool. So over a long game, they will be the ice that see the least accesses on your service.
And the third type of ice is threatening ice. Yes. So is threatening ice Shinobi?
Shinobi's a little bit of a strangely different beast.
There's a mixture of threatening and taxing.
It's actually, it's kind of all threat all the time. Actually, it is all threat all the time. Yeah. I take that back, yeah. Because it's actually very cheap to go through once you give them that bad bub, provided they have like a data sucker. So just in the metagame itself, it is not really that taxing. In a different metagame, maybe one with more femmes, or maybe one with more emphasis on maybe like pipeline, yeah, it will probably be considered like a blend of taxing and threatening. But in the metagame that we know and love right now, it's not at all taxing. But yeah, like, it is a good example of ice that presents threat. The Grails are a great example of ice that presents threat, because you're threatening to trash their programs or even kill them as the runner, as well as do something like end the run. And it's very hard to make those runs against it without having a solid foundation of resources set. Komayan is also a really great example of a threatening piece of ice. Even if you run into it, even though it's only got one strength and it can't actually kill them. The fact that it can sometimes take 5 or 6 credits to break, or a whole fairy, it means that the runner needs to invest in that run long before they get to make it. So that's kind of how Threatening Eyes works. For the runner to aptly play around Threatening Eyes, they need to essentially just sit back and accumulate those resources, which is why they're great mid-range eyes, because they let you get through the mid-game, even when they have their breakers, even when they have their mimic for your Tsurugi and your Komainu. They let you find early enough windows to score just by having stronger subroutines against your opponent's hand size or against your opponent's board. They need to do more to protect that than simply find their breaker.
I think in terms of the Grail Ice being threatening too, we've seen some really interesting tools coming in for them. Again, I don't think anyone's figured it out yet, but I know I was playing against a Foundry list the other day. My opponent rezzed a Merlin, tutored up their other Merlin, revealed the Merlin to the Merlin. I took four, went down to one card in hand. Then my opponent rezzed the twins and trashed the Merlin and revealed another Merlin and killed me. I
You got
think, I mean,
got.
there's all kinds of threat like that that's going to be coming out. And like the twins, I think we all thought it was a pretty bland piece of ice, but it could be good in a list like that,
It's also one influence to play,
Yeah.
so that you could see Twins Merlin in any kind of Foundry list, or even just lists that want to play something like Jackson. It certainly has capacity to do some damage. So just drawing this back, so I've recategorized my understanding of ice according to binary, threatening, and taxing ice. And as you might imagine, there are three categorizations of ice, and binary ice are better early when they don't have their breakers, they buy you tempo. Threatening ice are better in the mid game because they take so much to go through in terms of development of both the hand and the board. Taxing ice are better in the long game because they punish the runner more for expending their resources in ways that don't benefit them in terms of their game plan, which is scoring points.
I think it's worth pointing out that some of the ice breakers that are designed just to go through those more taxing ice aren't actually a straight up answer to that. Because something like your Morningstar or your Torch, sure, it can make the Heimdall or the Tollbooth not that threatening, not that taxing. But if you're installing that and your opponent raises a quandary, then they've bought you back there. So it's not a straight up answer. So I know some people think that, well, if taxing ice becomes a thing, I'll just play giant breakers. That's not really going to fix the problem.
Yeah, I think as runners, you really need to choose your battles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think shapers are probably the best suited for shaping their game.
Yeah.
Who would have thought it? They have test run, they have good, efficient barrier breakers in their dog and their Inti, both very cheap.
They sort of lend themselves to toolbox builds, as people refer to them, right?
Well, yeah, and the actual
And
console.
the actual console of the
Yeah,
toolbox,
yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, shapers certainly do lend themselves more to that mid-game abusing strategy or that long-game strategy. Most of their breakers scale quite nicely, so they do well in the long game where you do want flexible ice and you want to have to pay a little bit more to get in there. They have Maker's Iron Faction as well, and indexing, all these big effects that you invest a turn in to get maximum reward out of. But you still need to set up for that turn. And if we think about a game where you do very little and set up for one turn where you do a lot, we tend to think of that as a mid-range strategy, or where you do very little and then you continue doing very little and then eventually have inevitability. Well, that's a control strategy.
So, in closing on this topic, do you think sort of your recategorization of the ice and our sort of attempt to recategorize the way people think about different types of decks, do you think it's going to be worthwhile in the long run if people sort of switch to this sort of mindset? Do you think it's going to help?
Absolutely. It's going to be really, this has already been very good for me in rethinking the metagame, and even some things that seemed unrelated when I started playing, as in what two decks should I play? Should my runner deck have any influence on what corp deck I play? Little things like that I thought inconsequential when I first started playing, I'm feeling now are quite consequential. And it's because of just looking back from what we said at the start of the episode, it is because as a slower runner or as a slower corp, you do give up so much impetus, and you do lean more into variance. Maybe you don't draw your breaker in the early game, and they just score behind
Paper
that
wall.
paper wall or whatever. Because you are not the beatdown, and you have elements of variance against you, and it takes more time. We got to remember that this is the tournament setting, and it takes more time. There is actually a higher cost to playing slower decks or controllier decks, even though in the vacuum they are much more powerful. At the other end of the scale, we've got these aggro decks, which we tend to build in ways that are hyper consistent. Kit with Refractor and maybe some recurring credits. Very aggressive because every single game she gets to have access to one of the central servers every turn just because of her ability. Next design, we went into talking about RP. At the other end of that, they also printed Mushin Notion, which gave Corp decks insane capacity to be aggressive. In next design, you play ICE on your three central servers, then you play Mushin Noshin and put ICE in front of that. What are they going to do? They're going to check that ICE. Fantastic. Can I find the breaker? No? Great. I just scored a 5-for-3 on turn one. And now I get to install a 3-for-2 in that remote as well. Did they find their breaker yet? No? Great. I'm going to score a beta test. I'm going to put some ICE in there. Can they break into archives? No. It doesn't matter what I put in there then. I'm just going to run my beta test. Great. Oh, they found their breaker. Great. Biotic labor. I win. Fantastic.
Okay, good.
You know? You can score three agendas in 4 turns or whatever, straight up to 7 points. And that's not even a far-fetched. And so looking towards those identities that do give you a very aggressive opening or a very consistent aggressive strategy, the way we're going to go with these aggressive co-ops and aggressive runners. So they are in general quite, very consistent. They can abuse that variance and they have that initiative very early. So they're not paying those costs that we talked about that the control decks are paying.
That sounds a bit like a Psy game in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is a Psy game. It's the meta Psy
The
game.
meta Psy game.
Your zero is your aggro deck, your one is your mid-range deck, and your two is your control deck.
And obviously, when deciding which type of deck to play, you just roll a dice, don't you?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much,
Yeah.
yeah.
Chilsey, just while it's you and me, I thought we'd take the time to talk about a subject which is not necessarily strategy based or anything like that, but there's just two of us, so we can able to take it a bit deeper, a bit more personal. I think anyone who is consistently going to a tournament and identifies as a competitive player, someone who's always going to be in the scene for Netrunner tournaments and competitive Netrunner, sort of has a bit of an obligation to set the tone for the rest of the community. When a fresh-faced Netrunner player comes to their first tournament, they're going to enjoy their experience. You know, they're going to have a great time, regardless of what's going on. So what we're going to get at here is something that a few people have asked us to speak about, and that's the concept of tilt. Tilting is a phrase often used in Magic, again, but it actually comes from poker. Yeah, it means so you start losing and maybe you have a bad game and you get frustrated. Not only does your next game suffer because you're still tilted at that whatever happened in your first game, you can become an unpleasant person,
A
you know,
very
a
unpleasant
very unpleasant
person.
person. And like there's a sort of nirvana you can get to as a competitive player, like which I don't think I'm at yet. I mean, when I first started playing competitive card games, and this wasn't just Netrunner, this was back in Magic days as well, and I lost a game, I would blame anything else but what I did. My opponent got lucky, or they got lucky. I would be angry at somebody else, you know. I'd be angry at my opponent, like, oh, that, and I'd go and tell my friends, you're like, oh, that fucking mouth breather just beat me down. And I did this all the time until one of my friends pointed out to me and says, I reckon every time you lose, you come and tell me something weird about what your opponent was wearing or something like that. And I'm like, yeah, that is really bad. Like, why am I doing that? Like, I mean, my opponent's a reasonable person too. He's a human being. And then I started sort of reflecting on this. Well, maybe I need to look a bit more inwardly. So now I'm at the stage, which I think is sort of stage two, where I get angry at myself. You know, because I made mistakes, and I think there's probably a third stage you get to where you're not angry at all, you know, and it's really hard to get
You're
to.
just over being a sour person.
I'm not there yet. I've still got so much sour juice in me, but like, Shizzy, you've been playing competitive card games for a long time, longer than me. Did you go through a similar development?
Oh, dude, I'm a tilt fiend. I'm like slippery floor kind of hazard. I used to travel all around, like catch planes and car trips to like Adelaide or whatever. One time, when I finally made a top 8 in a PTQ in Adelaide.
Pro Tour qualifier is like equivalent to a national, so like the winner of that tournament gets airfare paid for to
Yeah,
wherever the
it's a
Pro
massive
Tour is. So
thing.
it's a huge thing, yeah.
It's a huge deal. Yeah, you get flown internationally.
Wolfie has won 3 of these.
Yeah, Wolfie's a machine. I finally top 8 at one of these events and made it to the top 4, I think. The thing about tilting, the thing about just like that anger swelling up and just like that indignity swelling up inside you is that it's not like any other bluff. You can't just write that off. And when you see your opponent tilting hard, it's not a worthwhile enough experience for somebody to try and bluff it. It's a very clear tell, which is why it's such an important concept in poker.
So, I mean, Netrunner is similar enough to have it be the same issue. Like, if
Basically,
you're tilting because you've been co-op and the last 4 cards you've drawn have all been agendas, and you sit there starting to get like huffy and puffy, thinking, how the friggin' hell did I get to the top 4 of the store championship? And now I'm just drawing agendas. Why is this happening now and not in round one? Then your opponent's like, I'm probably going to run your HQ 4 times. Like, you know,
It's like, oh, I crushed every game all day, and finally I'm gonna lose one game, and it's the final. It's like the only game I could have lost is the most important. You know, it makes you feel quite indignant. You don't really feel like you deserve that. So it's not worth ever feeling that as like a bluff. So people will see it and they will get into it. But in this game of Magic, I just bricked a bunch of times in a row and my opponent knew it and he just beat me down. Yeah, and I died on like turn 4 or something, and And I swore never to return to Adelaide, and I haven't.
That's how deep your tilt has run.
My tilt runs very deep, yes.
So, like, the other issue with tilt is, right, if you're... And there are some people who get aggressively tilted, and they can sort of take it out on their opponent, and it's really not fair for that to happen. It's not... One, it's not fair for the opponent, and two, if it's an event, there are people watching, it makes a lot of people uncomfortable. You know, I've been in situations where, I'm the first to admit when I'm playing the runner, and my opponent just gets shit unlucky from the looks of things. So, like, they turn one, don't ice up R&D, which is a fine decision to make when they're playing against criminal. I run R&D 3 times and score 6 points. I'm like, well, fuck, you know. But if they then start swearing at me and telling me that I'm just a luck sack, and, you know, should we do a segment on our on our podcast about how to be a luck sack?
You extraordinary plucker.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Then like, that's not the kind of environment we want to have. You know, you need to be able to look back and think, well, you know, sure, I got really unlucky then. You know, I still made the right choice.
Yeah,
I think you need to look at the choices you could have made, and if there was a different choice you could have made, would you have made that choice? I mean, you made a decision made based on the information you had at the time, and you got to not let that get you angry at your opponent, you know?
Mm. Yeah, and, like, I've got thick skin, and you've got thick skin.
Mm. Okay. Of course, but, other people don't.
You can take a lot of crap. But, yeah, like, anyone could be playing their first event, and it would be kind of hypocritical for us to have this entire, podcast series celebrating competitive play and telling people, explore your decks and try and be the best you can be, and like, go out to the tournament and, like, crush people, and then be like, and you should rub their faces in it while you do it, you know?
Yeah, we certainly don't want to do that.
Grab them by the nose and just, like, rub them in that astro pile.
Yeah. And, like, similarly, if you're suspecting that your opponent is tilted, sometimes you might think it'll help to mention that they got unlucky.
No.
It's not the case. If you score your third astro because they missed on every R&D run and didn't get the 1 in 5 card in your hand and you win the game, don't say, oh man, that was bad luck.
Yeah.
For you.
Like, bad don't. Luck. Bad luck,
buddy. You know, because it's, we know that you're trying to be pleasant and you're trying to take the burn off, but it can come off as smug. And secondly, it's like, yeah, I know, I missed. You don't need to tell me. I know. Yeah. And it can help. It can make it worse. And that's why I think if you're ever feeling tilted when you lose the thing, I think if any, you know, we have the concept of the handshake after a competitive game. I'm of the opinion that the loser should always offer the handshake first.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. If you are sure that you're in a position to win, just be patient. Your opponent will work that out. They'll concede, or they will, you know, count up the agenda pile again and see that it comes to 7 or 8 or whatever, and they'll check it again. They'll check theirs, make sure that theirs isn't miraculously 7 as well. They'll work it out, and they'll extend the hand, or they will just, like, snuff up and scoop up their cards really quickly and get out of there. Either is fine. Yeah, either is fine,
sure,
for you.
Sure.
You can't take that personally because that's their tilt. That's their problem. That's their beast. They can deal with that.
And that's what we're talking about, is that if you are that person, you need to learn how to deal with that in a way that doesn't create a negative environment for people to come
in. If you are that person and you're sure that you've just lost and you're really mad about it, extend the hand. Don't say anything. Don't respond to anything they say, because they can be just as much of a dickhead as you could be, and then just get out of there. Go have a ciggy, or if you're not into smoking, go have a soda, or if you're like Brian and refuse to drink carbonated anything, go just have a glass of water and sit down and breathe some fresh air. Or whatever,
and then after 10 minutes, find your teammate, your buddy who you came to the tournament with, and tell them, dude, I just lost so hard. And if you're their buddy, be like, dude, tell me what happened. Let it out, you know? Like, why did you lose? Like, bad beat stories is a reason we have them.
Yeah.
And also, conversely, no one likes that guy who constantly talks about how hard he was winning. Everyone's got to have bad beat stories, and they're the stories that you should be sharing.
It's like, oh, I rocked up to this event with these two awful decks that I just built 20 minutes ago and face rolled, you know? I put my face on the keyboard and rolled around. And
and like, another way to deal with this, like, a good friend of ours, Russell Cutting, who ironically met in Adelaide, where Shilsey's never going to go again.
I probably will go back to Adelaide at some point. Yeah.
He's a fine Magic player, and on the inside of his deck books, he has written, keep calm and enjoy this children's card game.
Yeah.
Full stop. You look good. If that's something that might help you, and just put it in perspective, like, at the end of the day, you are playing Netrunner, and while we enjoy Netrunner and we love competitive card games, it's still a card game which is ridiculous.
And it's a privilege to play.
Of course, yeah, like, sure.
Lucas Litzinger and co. have put in a fantastic amount of effort to produce a game that, at the end of the day, they have prioritized in making fun. So whenever you feel like something's going wrong and you're walking away thinking, oh, you know, this game's broken, they should never have printed Jackson Howard or whatever.
Astroscript should be restricted.
Astroscript should be restricted. Yeah. You know what? Like, you had fun up until this point.
Yeah.
If you're really not having fun playing the game, if you really hate everyone that's involved playing the game as well, what are you doing there? You keep coming back. Is it some kind of irrational behavior? There's just as many ways that tilt can keep you in the game as can force you out. If you're a bad winner, there's a good chance you're tilting about something. Yeah, so kind of working these things out and having a bit of dignity and treating your opponents with respect, all these things come together and all of these things affect the way that you tilt and the way that you can get over your tilt.
Like the way people perceive you as well and perceive the environment. Like I'm saying, again, if you're that person who's shown up to their first Netrunner tournament and you see this person tilt out and, you know, yell at his opponent or get aggressive at his opponent in round one, and you get paired against him in round two because it's your first tournament, you just lost as well. You know, I've been in a situation where I'm like, gee, this guy's like taller than me and I'm pretty tall, you know, and this guy's really angry. Like, I don't want to beat him, you know, like I've been in that situation and it sucks, you know, and you want to be like, oh, hey, buddy, you know, you want to be friendly. And it's really important. Like, I think Netrunner, like in Melbourne and from what Jesse's told us, you know, across the world and from what Dave has told us in Europe, he's got a very, very good community. Yeah, and what Hollis has told us from Midwest. Just correct us if we're wrong there, Hollis. But
the Netrunner, any chance to hear from Hollis is a good vibe to send into.
But yeah, and there's a reason that the community is good, and we want to keep it like that. So we know that there's a few people that are like this, and if you are like that, we're talking to you right now. As Shielzy and I have expressed, we've been like that before, and we know you can get better, and it's fine. I think it's a really important thing to do. Think of it as a personal development exercise.
Oh yeah, in a lot of ways, like you have to be angry at some point. You have to be tilted.
It's human. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's exactly. You invest so much time and so much emotion and so much energy into the game. You know, you are prioritized going out, you know, taking a day off work or whatever. You prioritize not seeing those friends that don't play to come to this tournament and then playing against some people that are like bad winners or whatever, or even just bad losers. And they piss you off. That's absolutely fine. And, you know, in some ways you kind of have to reach these points of severe anger so that you can deal with them, you know, and kind of come full circle on that anger when the anger is so bad that you actually decide to either just put it away or quit the game. Like, that's, you got to come into that position before you can really decide to actually do something about it. Because you can't just abstractly say, you know, I'm never going to be angry again in my life unless you're actually dealing with it in some way.
Of course, yeah. That's all we have time for tonight. If you want to get in contact with us, you can do so by shooting us an email at thewinningagenda@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter @winningagenda or check us out on Facebook. Our like page is The Winning Agenda. Until next week, we've been your tiny, tiny panel.
And if you want to read an excellent article on tilting, I suggest we'll leave a link in the show notes to an excellent article by Matt Giles.
Yes, Matt Giles is a Perth-based Magic the Gathering player who is an extremely gifted and talented writer, and everything he's written, even if you don't play Magic, is completely relevant to your life. Mm-hmm. So we highly recommend you check it out. We'll leave a link in the show notes, as you say.
Cool, yeah, no worries.
Till next week, guys. See ya.
Cheers. Hey, Owen, it's Liam and Brian. You're on the air.
What?
Yeah, we're talking about tilt.
Talking about what? Tilt?
Tilt, yeah. You want to hear about tilt?
Oh, you're recording now?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you want me to say?
Do you tilt very much, Owen? What's your experience with tilt been?
I mean, everybody tilts, right?